Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, actress and filmmaker Victoria Lacoste talks about choosing to be a filmmaker.
I didn't have a lot of self-confidence. So it was all of a sudden being in front of an audience, to be able to kind of express something through a character and being in front of these people and having all the fears just vanish. And that was something I never forgot. And it's quite addictive. So I think that's really how it started, is I was like, okay, I have to be doing this for the rest of my life.
Today on the show, actress-producer Victoria Lacoste talks about her decision to become a filmmaker. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Victoria Lacoste, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California, where you're a longtime fan of the show of 10 and a half years, baby Jesus, or you're a new fan. Welcome to Storyworthy. Now, listen, I don't know if you guys heard the story last week by broadcaster Steve Mason, but this guy blew my mind. Victoria, you couldn't have heard the show because it didn't air yet, but Steve Mason, broadcaster Steve Mason, he talks about being buried alive.
Oh.
Yeah.
What is that like?
Yeah, right? What is that like? Well, what it was when he was a younger man and he was a DJ at a radio station, and it was like not a gag, but like a bit on the radio station to raise money. So it was like I'm trying to think of the word. It was like, you know, a radio gag, you know? So the radio station, because they were, you know, wacky DJs. And so they dug a hole 6 feet deep in the middle of Toledo, which is a city in Ohio, if you didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Okay.
Good
morning. And yeah, because you grew up in Switzerland, right?
I did. So I have a fairly solid grasp on American geography.
Well, listen, you're not the only one that doesn't know Toledo, but I will say this, a lot of scales are made there. So a lot of people say, if you're from Toledo, they say, oh, what do you weigh? It's a joke.
Oh, well, interesting.
Yeah. Have you heard of Cleveland? Have you heard of Cleveland?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
They call that the mistake absolutely. On the lake. I don't know if you've heard that.
I've heard other sayings.
Anyway, so Steve Mason gets buried alive in a park for 48 hours. I shit you not. You got to go back. You guys got to listen to Steve Mason. What an amazing story he has. But not today. Don't go anywhere today, because I'm talking today to a very interesting person. And I'm just so excited that our paths are crossing, because it's stunning who you are, your background, and your whole story. So Victoria Lacoste is here, and she brings forth the topic choosing to be a filmmaker. So there's like two parts to that whole sentence. And the first part is that you're Victoria Lacoste from the very influential and important family, the Lacoste family. And your grandfather was a stunning tennis player.
Yes, correct.
I find that amazing right there. He won the Davis Cup years ago. I mean, this is like the late 20s.
Yes, he actually won. His career started in the 20s, and he really gained fame in the 30s. So, and that's,
yeah.
So it's like, yeah, his career kind of evolved, but it was he very much the industry, especially sports industry, was really changing at the time. And that's when he gained prominence in the 30s. And yeah, he was
nicknamed the crocodile because of how he dealt with his opponents.
Yes.
And therefore we move into, he is the creator of the Lacoste tennis shirt, which he introduced in 1929.
Yes.
It's fascinating.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's wild, because it his whole story is it really came from initially wanting tennis players to wear outfits that weren't too hot, because back in the day, tennis players would wear suits and dress shoes to play tennis. It was considered a very, like, you know, it was a very elegant, very bourgeois kind of sport, and yeah, you had to dress up. No one was wearing sports clothing whatsoever. And he basically invented the polo, the like, you know, the way you weave the polo, and the, you know, that's something he coined and invented. you know, because it's breathable. And when you play sports, you can actually, you know, have air flow through as opposed to wearing a suit that's way too hot. And
well, there's so many things. Yeah. There's so many things because first of all, I play tennis like 5 days a week. You're looking at a tennis injury right here. You see my thumb, but I have my thumb, you guys, in a little cast thing anyway. But, you know, tennis, it has evolved so much, but like, it's so much part of my life. So I automatically, you know, obviously your family's name, Lacoste, it was a big deal in the United States in the 70s, but it was also very expensive and out of our, what we could afford as a family. So we would buy the alligator shirts. By the way, we call them alligator shirts, not crocodile shirts. I wonder why. I don't even know if you can discern between an alligator and a crocodile. Can you?
It took me years, and I've only learned because my dad would always correct us and be like, no, this is actually an alligator, but they're very, crocodiles are a lot bigger and they're simply a way, but I still get them mixed up. And it's funny because sometimes people say the shirt has an alligator. Sometimes they say it's a crocodile. Even my dad will sometimes say one or the other. So I even don't quite know which one it's really meant to be, but I think it's an alligator. As a matter of fact,
it's just so funny. So, well, what we would do quickly is we would buy them in the little boys department where they were cheaper. Mm-hmm. That was the same shirt, but it was sized differently. But they look the same.
But they look the same, exactly.
So check this out. There are no alligators in Australia. There's only crocodiles. And in America, there's only alligators, no crocodiles.
I didn't know. I didn't know. I was like, I didn't actually know that. Or I think I knew, but then I forgot.
I don't think it's all that interesting, but that's true.
I think it is. I'm a big big animal person. So this is of definite interest to me. I was like, oh.
So the question is, do you play tennis?
I do not play tennis. And no, it's very disappointing to a lot of people who meet me. I actually have a very funny story. My dad has tried to make, because I have three younger brothers who are triplets. So there's four of us in the family. And my dad actually tried to make us play tennis one summer. And he brought us to a tennis camp. And I was so bad at tennis that I was probably 8 years old. And I was relegated with like the little, like the youngest group with like the 4 year olds, because that's how horrible of a player I was. It was a complete failure, but he tried.
That is so funny because you must have been so tall on the court. And then all the little ones, you're with the children.
100%. 100%. It was a little pathetic, but you know, I knew this wasn't for me. It's just that really sealed the deal. And my dad never even tried to like sell me on the sport ever again. It's just the genes didn't pass, I guess.
Yeah. So it's your dad's father then who, how interesting. Yeah. And is your dad still with us?
My dad is still with us. My grandfather, the creator of the brand Rene, he isn't. He died when I was pretty young because he was already fairly old when I was born. And I met him when I was a toddler, but I don't have any memory of it. But I know a lot about him from, you know, from my family, and I hear a lot of anecdotes. So I have a fair idea of how he was, but I couldn't, you know, tell you from personal experience.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting though. And so you have, let me first start with this. The clothes are really nice. Mm-hmm. Like the clothes were always very breathable. Do you have a favorite piece of the sportswear that you wear, or a favorite anything, like a favorite watch? Because now they make everything.
They do. I mean, they've been making a lot of, they've been making everything for a little while, but I would say it kept in the last few years, it's been expanding even more. I'd say one thing they did really well is that it expanded the line to like a more, I would say like a more like a youthful audience. So I'd say the brand is more, feels more modern, as if like, you know, 10 years ago, and it's been evolving. I'm going to disappoint you. I hardly wear the brands, if ever at all. I don't wear it.
That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Is that just because you're in Paris and everybody in Paris wears kind of, you know, more demure, darker clothing and nicer fabrics, or what is it?
No, because Parisians actually really like the brand. It's not that. And I know a lot of my friends actually, it's the irony of it. I have a lot of friends who are actors and they get sponsored by the brand. So they go movies and they wear the brand. And so they're like, oh, I love this shirt, this polo. And I'm like, great. I don't wear it. And the reason why, I think, is when you grow up with the name, you're already wearing the brand. You know what I mean? You don't want to, on top of it, wear a clothing that reminds people. It's like, oh, you're Victoria Lacoste, you're wearing a polo. Like, I cannot tell you how many times I went to school with, you know, I mean, not really wearing ever Lacoste, but the few times I did, it's like, it's calling attention to it again, because I'm someone, it's kind of ironic because I'm a filmmaker, but I'm also very private. And it's not something I like to wear. Literally, I don't like to wear it on my sleeve, because it's just, sometimes it backfires, if I'm completely honest with you. Like, so it's like and you know, the brand was sold the brands a few years ago. So it's not, you know, we still have ties to it, obviously, because it's a family history. And my dad has dedicated his life to the brand, and it will never not be a part of us. It's just that, to me, I always try to have my own thing going on, and calling attention to it almost, it hurt me more than it did good, if that makes sense. Like, there are times where I was just like, you know, as a teenager, especially, you're kind of rebelling. You're like, I don't want anyone to know. And you learn, you know, like, everything. It has, obviously has pros, but it also has downsides. Like, you know, when you have a name or so, yeah, that's why I just never wear it, really.
But it's fascinating. And I totally understand everything you just said. It's like, if you were part of the Levi fortune, you would always wear Levi's. Yeah. It would just seem like, yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. It's funny though, because it could go one way or the other. In other words, you could have been interested, become a financier, become a business person, like a lot of your family members. And at that point, I was just thinking it might have been more personal, now that you explained that, you know, it got sold off to different entities. But because I was just thinking, like, who would you call and say, like, oh my God, I love that sweater. That sweater is the one. Yeah. That would be impossible. That's like saying, yeah, that's impossible. That's like saying Matt Groening's son would comment on the show.
It's hard. You don't have any distance. And to be honest, it is difficult because you don't have any distance. Their items of clothing, I think, are awesome, especially the later collections, which I shouldn't say because it's not ours anymore. But I was talking about it the other day, is that, you know, the new owners have done really good things with the brand, and things I would definitely want to wear. So who knows? It's just, you know, sometimes it's just, you go through phases where you want to have your individuality. You don't want to be associated because it's already there, so prevalent in your day-to-day life. And, you know, I say that, and that's why I always empathize with, you know, people who are sons and daughters, famous actors, for instance, and who decide to go on the same path, because you're always going to be brought back to it. I'm at least in a different field. So even though people make the connection, I'm not being compared, and people aren't like, oh, well, you know, I mean, they're not like, oh, well, your dad did this, and why? You're always going to be compared, and at the very least, you know, so I get it.
Yeah. It's, if nothing else, it is of interest. Yes. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely. It just is. Tell me about your triplet siblings. That's so interesting.
Yes. I have three brothers. They're triplets. They're 24 years old. They just turned 24 in 2 weeks ago. I'm 26. So we're 2.5 years apart. It's funny because they're very, very different from each other, and they're triplets. So everyone thinks they're the same, but they have very distinct personalities, and they're all in very different fields. So they're more, you know, two of them are more, one of them is very much in the finance world. One of them is in, you know, sells softwares. And the third one is in like studies gems. So they're in like I know he does gemology. It's really interesting. The three of them are very, very different physically, and in their own right, they Yeah, it's fascinating.
So they call them fraternal triplets then? They're fraternal?
Yeah, fraternal, exactly. And I believe you can't have real triplets because the egg can't, separating three. Sometimes you can have real twins where it's like one egg, but like that then splits, but you can't have one egg split in three. So sometimes I believe, and for maybe I'm completely wrong and someone will say it, but you can, sometimes have two for two real and one separate.
So, what are your brothers' names?
William, Antoine, and Maxime.
How interesting. What does the rock one do? He goes to Australia and he tell me that.
Gemology, I believe that's how you say it in English. Maybe it's a different term, but right now he's still studying it. So he's not at the point where he's going and like seeing it, but I know he's studying it. That's an interest he took during quarantine. He came up to me and was like, Victoria, I think I'm going to actually start studying gems, even though he already has a master's degree in finance, but he somehow chose, and everyone through quarantine has had a moment where they were like, maybe I should just completely switch interests. And I think that's what happened with him. So he just, for the moment, he's still studying it.
In Australia.
No, in Switzerland.
That's so fascinating. So that's more of a creative side then. That's more creative than.
He's a little more creatively, I would say out of the three, he's definitely a little bit more creatively, what's the word I'm looking for? He has a penchant for more of the creative things. And since he was little, so I was like, oh, this makes sense.
Yeah. Your English is perfect. You guys all grew up learning French and English.
I learned English when I was a little bit older. I actually spoke German before I spoke English, but it was always around. Like I watched a lot of, I always joke, but it's actually not a joke, that I learned English watching shows,
Yeah.
TV, literally watching TV in English all like every day. And I just trained myself to
What were
sound.
you watching? I'm curious.
Don't laugh, but I was watching Desperate Housewives. That's how it started. It was Desperate Housewives. It's not a joke. It's a real thing.
Well, it's really
Really?
smart though, because it's very conversational.
Yeah, exactly. And it's pretty simple. Like the stories, there are all these intrigues, but it's something you can follow. I was 10 years old and I was watching it with, subtitles because in English it just sounds so much better. And I was like, oh my God, I need to stop watching things that are dubbed in French because it just doesn't sound good.
That is really interesting, probably because there's so many nuances in the English language. You know, there's so many words that sound similar and that are similar. And we've got the homonyms and the synonyms, and I don't even
Just
know.
like just I mean just like in French, but you have more words and the humor is different. And when you
Sure.
do to dubbing, I have French friends who do that for like TV shows where they do the French voices for famous American actors, and they always joke to me and they're like, it's so, even though it's still so bad because it doesn't translate, you can't translate it the right way. You have It changes the meaning, so the humor gets so lost.
I have written on my page Daryl Hannah. Why do I have that written down? Did we talk about that at all?
No, we didn't
I
actually.
wonder why I wrote that down. It'll come to me. It'll come to
I'll
me.
come to you.
Anyway, I'm really excited to hear your story because part of your story is kind of what we've already been talking about. So I kind of want to get over to your story so we can hear more about it. But before we do, I did want to remind everybody that we are playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night, live on Facebook and YouTube. Victoria, you would laugh so hard. We're playing tonight. Now, of course, now I'm in Los Angeles. You're in Paris. So I think we're already at like an 8-hour time difference.
We're 9 hours apart, even. We're even bigger.
9 hours
Yes.
apart. Yeah. So that might be tricky for you because we start the show at 7 p.m. on Friday night. So for you, that would be like 4 in the morning. So if you want to get up.
I've done that. I have done that as of late. Because in production, I go to bed. Rarely do I go to bed before 4 a.m. at the moment. So actually, there's a chance it might work perfectly.
Oh, that's so interesting because I guess you're in production with people here in LA in different
Different
places. And so.
places, exactly. Different places. So there are people I talk to in LA, and also in general, I'm a bit of a night owl. So I tend to be more, my brain tends to be just more creative at night. So that's just
Sure,
going.
sure. Isn't it crazy? Like a year ago, we never would have seen any of this coming.
Never. No, it's wild. Yeah, I was thinking it's almost gonna be a year. We started our first quarantine March 15th in France. and Europe in general, but that's when it's all started kind of going downhill, and it's almost been a year. Yeah. Pretty wild. Pretty wild.
But not just the pandemic, but like now what we've had to do and what, like what we're doing now, like we wouldn't have been doing this last year because it wouldn't have occurred to us.
Yeah, exactly.
To connect this way. Like I had 600 guests in person. I've never had people via a satellite or whatever. You know, it's always been in person, and now I get to talk to you. So in a way, that I think has been one good thing that's come out of this.
I absolutely, there's in a weird way, it's what I've said is that there've been a lot of downsides to what's happened, but I've also connected with people I otherwise would have never connected with, because people have, you know, stopped their plans, they've stayed or moved to different places, and I've had opportunities come up that I would otherwise never even have thought about, to be honest.
Yeah. So it's like now you can collaborate with people that it really opens up doors in a way. Anyway, you guys, we do play Story Smash every Friday night, and you can head over to storysmashshow.com and you'll see the whole game show. Also, the shows are on YouTube. So you can go over to YouTube, Christine Blackburn, and you'll see the last 11 episodes. It's funny. I've been doing the show for over 10 years, but it's always been at the improv or, you know, at a comedy club. And now, obviously, during the pandemic, we haven't been able to do that. But now we've got it sorted out, and now we're doing something different. But it still works. I mean, it actually is working really funny. And we're getting tons of viewers because it's on Facebook and it's on YouTube, and there's no tickets involved. So that has made a big difference. And anyway, you guys, Story Smash, it's the funniest hour of the week. I guarantee it. All right, you guys, she's here right now, Victoria Lacoste. You've heard her talking. She is an actress and a producer. And
yeah, correct. That's correct.
Okay, so you bring forth the topic today, choosing to be a filmmaker. And I'm anxious to hear that, because when you would not come out, but okay, yeah, come out to tell people I'm going to be a filmmaker or an actress or a musician or whatever, what you're telling people is that I'm choosing a path that is very, very unclear, and anything could happen. And
oh yes,
it's hard for some people to imagine, because especially like your family coming from financing, they must think you're bananas. So I'm anxious to hear the story, because that's definitely, you know, I'm the only one in my family who's so-called left. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I have four older sisters and an older brother, and I'm the only one that left, you know. Because, and what I'm doing, it's not safe. You know, it's not for certain. And it's, I mean, I still have coin laundry. So it's, you know, it's not the same lifestyle. So I know your story is going to be really good. And we're going to get to that right now. Okay, you guys, wherever you are, Victoria Lacoste, you heard her talking. She is an actress and a producer. And now you have a production company called Edelweiss, right?
Correct. Yes.
And that's very interesting, because to have a production company, does that mean that you have like go-to people that you're going to hand over to the camera department or the lighting department? Is that what that means?
Yes. I mean, that can definitely be a part of it, because when you're a producer, you build a network of people that you trust. I would say that's the most important and probably the biggest part of the job, is finding people that you trust, that you can work with, that you could put up with. And I say that, can put up with you as well. And yeah, definitely there are people that, you know, I mean, you know, you find crews a lot of the time with people that are, you trust for certain, you know, positions. And also part of it is coordinating this and finding funds to finance a movie. So there are different aspects to production, and different producers can do different things. And sometimes there are producers that are there to, you know, coordinate everyone, make sure the right people come together. And I think to me, that would be the crux of it, is like making sure we have a cohesive team, you know, because it's hard enough to make a movie, even when you have the right people. So if you don't have the right people or the right energy, it's just, you know, it can be very chaotic.
Because it's a creative process, and you have to have like people on board that you can be with 12 hours a day or whatever.
Absolutely.
Did you go to filmmaking school?
I didn't. So I went to theater. Actually, I studied theater in university. So I left home when I was 18. I actually spent a year in Australia where I worked at a zoo. That's a whole other story.
Otherwise, you could go. Wait, were you going to be like a little Bindi, whatever
her name was? That was the dream. For a long time, that was the dream. Yes, that was my other dream. I had two dreams. I had the dream of acting, but I also had a dream of like, well, actually, I love animals and I want to handle snakes all day, which I did for months where that was, you know, I had this side of myself, this kind of nature girl since I've been little. It's my other, you know, but I have two passions. There's definitely production and acting, like right underneath, right there. There's, you know, animals. And so, yeah.
Did you handle poisonous snakes? Because Australia has some fucking poisonous stuff.
They're snake. Yeah, they're venomous snakes. They're terrifying. I have not had to handle it because I think legally that was not, you know, they wouldn't have let me do it. However, I handled a lot of, remember handling a lot of lizards and non-venomous snakes. That were just, you know, pretty
well,
harmless.
Well, in Australia, they have those like Komodo dragons,
yes,
right? Don't they have those?
Yes.
And that's not a lizard. That's like a flipping Godzilla came out of the swamp.
100%. And they're dangerous and their saliva is toxic. Just something, you know, since we're talking about animal effects, I remember you bring up crocodiles and alligators, but like little fact, like they're terrifying creatures and they, you know, they're aggressive. I mean, they're not to be messed with. For sure. So I've definitely seen them, but I've never approached them because it's like a kind of a death sentence. So I left them where they were.
I've been to Australia just once. I do remember a lot of those, like, you know, we would be taking the bus, the Oz Experience. You're probably familiar. And we're on that Oz Experience bus. And then we go past these, kangaroo farm, mm-hmm. sheep farm, alligator or crocodile farm. There's so much of that down there, right?
Yeah, lots of crocodile farms. I definitely did a lot of, when I was there, I toured a lot of different, I worked at a zoo, but then I went to a lot of different, you know, because some zoos are more open range. There are zoos, yeah, there are definitely more like koala sanctuaries. So I right. went to koala sanctuaries, kangaroo sanctuaries, and it was in that sense, it was pretty heavenly because I was getting my animal fix. And also working really hard because work, you know, working that kind of work is, you know, being a zookeeper, it's no small fit in terms of you have to really want it. And it's very physical. It sounds very glamorous, but trust me, it's not. It's I very much a shout out to people who work in that field because I did it for a few months and then I was like, okay, this was an experience, but I don't think I would reiterate it.
Boy, that's pretty interesting because, I mean, I know that some people are out there mucking out the stalls or having to mm-hmm. clean the cages and all that. But mm-hmm. I thought like some zookeepers are just kind of walking around saying, yes, those are our gorillas. We got them 5 months ago, you know?
Yes, or, there's that part of the job that's true.
So you do that. You do both parts. You do like a zookeeper does all of it.
They do all of it. So I remember, I mean, I can't speak for all places, but I remember when I was in worked as in like volunteered rather at Melbourne Zoo for 4.5 months. And yeah, there are people who were, you know, there are definitely different tasks and, you know, a big part of it is cleaning, feeding the animals, you know, making sure, you know, everything is set in cages and, you know, interacting with them. But part, you know, they would go on, you know, education, some parts of it were more educational. And some keepers love that part where, you know, you have to explain, you know, you have to explain to people what they're looking at, because that's also the point of zoos, because, you know, this particular zoo was educational and that was their purpose. So yeah, you do both.
I think this is fascinating. I really do, Victoria. No. Here's what I know about Storyworthy. Nobody else is going to get that story out of you. That's pretty cool, man. That is pretty cool. And here's how I know for sure you're going to be a successful filmmaker / actress is because you left that behind. And that could have been a fine life.
Mm-hmm. It left leaving behind the zoo stuff? Or
Australia
behind?
In general. Yes, Australia is a fabulous country. Super easy to be there, right?
Yes. Although I will be totally honest, it was actually a very tough year because it was one of these things where you leave and you're 18, you're like, oh, I'm going to go on a gap year and la la la. And you're being, you know, like I'm leaving all of you guys behind and I'm living the dream. And it wasn't, there were, you know, when you travel alone and when you're 18 years old, I was really young. I don't regret doing it, but I will say that I was actually pretty relieved to come back home because there were, you know, it was, the work was really hard. And then there were, you know, a lot of formative experiences that, you know, happen when traveling, and people have a very glamorous idea of what it means in Australia in general, because it is easygoing, but it wasn't an easy experience. Ironically,
well, first of all, it's slightly dangerous. I mean, I know Australia is safe, but there are also people that get kidnapped and sent down to these diamond mines to work the rest of their lives. And they're basically, they're kidnapped. I mean, that happens.
I've heard, you know, there were definitely some dangerous aspects because, when you're, you know, when you're traveling alone, there's definitely the aspect of danger, but also the aspect of just loneliness, because when you're traveling alone, it's very introspective. And I had just, you know, we had just sold, I mean, the company had just been sold. So I had, like, you know, just finished school, and I thought, you know, I'm going to, you know, challenge myself and go and, you know, be on my own for an entire year, on the other side of the world. So there were definitely a lot of challenging moments. There were some good moments too, but thinking back on it, I don't feel like nostalgic. I'm more like, this was a learning.
Okay. Is this a movie or what?
I mean,
come on. You want to talk about the movie to make. Victoria, this is the movie. I mean, it could be based on a true story. An heiress leaves Europe and everything in the world she could have, and she goes by herself to Australia to ride around on the Oz Experience and work on a sheep farm or work in a zoo. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it wasn't diamond mines that it's gold mines, right, down there?
They have a coal. I know there are coal mines for sure, because there are stories within stories, you know. That's why it was funny when we, you know, decided to do this podcast. I was like, what story? Because, you know, so many options, obviously. But yes, there are mines, and there are mining towns in the center of Australia. And actually a lot of people want to go into the mining business because you can make a lot of money, but it's extremely hard work. And that's why they pay people actually, you know, quite well to go into mining towns and stay there for months on end. Because it's hard. It's really hard work. So it's
but they're
a big
desperate
part of it.
People. They're desperate people too.
So they're desperate people. There's very much a melting pot of different kinds of people. And it was, I made some fascinating encounters when I was there, you know. Some better than others for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, especially in the Red Center there, there's some serious poverty.
Serious poverty. Also, one thing that really left a mark on me, and I think, you know, to a certain degree, it helped me build a certain consciousness. You know, when you travel, you know, you come from a very high place of privilege because you're a tourist and you're this and you're traveling, and you realize the effects the tourism has had, I think, on Australia, but other places that are really negative, whether it's on the environment, whether, you know, seeing also the way native populations are treated. That was a very, very heartbreaking experience, because it's like all the illusions that I had of like, I'm going to go and road trip and it's going to be so much fun. And, you know, you're 18. So you're like, this is going to be a paradise. And then you see, it was like all my illusions were, I don't want to say shattered, it's just a bit dramatic, but, you know, put a lot of things in perspective. And I was like,
it blew your mind.
It blew my mind. Blew my mind completely.
People don't know about the Aborigines unless they visit there. They don't really understand that there's, you know, it's not like, well, I guess it's sort of parallel to the American Indians, but the Aborigines is just thousands of more years of their culture. And they're nomads. So they just keep walking, right? They go on a walkabout for years.
I believe that's part of it. I don't know enough about Aborigines culture. I know there are different tribes live in very different ways, but yes, there is a culture of being nomad and movements. But the movement, I mean, the culture has been so hindered by same would happen in the United States when colonizers arrive and they just take over their land and instore laws and decide that, you know, this is like a savage way of living, whatever, which is a horrible word to begin with, because it's just not, I mean, and just wreck a culture that's one of the oldest cultures in the world, if not the oldest, is Aborigines culture in Australia, which a lot of people don't know about. So just that was very much a, you know, something I was aware of, but seeing it with my own eyes and seeing the state of poverty and desolation of certain areas, and especially, of course, native populations, was to see it, you know, you can know about things, but seeing them is an entirely different, you know, I wasn't uneducated about it. It was just being, you know, being surrounded was different.
18, that's very brave. That's impressive, man, for sure. All right. So also now you have made a couple of movies. The Fourth Wall, that was the best horror film, named the best horror film in Holly Shorts. That's a pretty big deal.
That is a pretty big deal. Yes, that is definitely a very cool. I mean, that was one of our proudest achievements with Kelsey Bullock, who's the writer and director of the short. Mm-hmm. Like, because every year, if I'm not mistaken, 6,000 shorts are sent out to Holly Shorts, and it's also where the Academy Awards do their selection. And ours, not only we were already happy that it was picked alone, like everything, we treat everything as like a big victory because, you know, we're like, well, we're proud of what we've done, but we never expect always the best to happen. And to win an award, you know, being part of the festival and then win, being one of the 30 movies that wins an award out of all these movies, to me, even though we'd won, we'd been through this festival circuit, we've been in other, what I would consider pretty good festivals. That was very much like my, okay, we have something. I was very proud, especially because we couldn't experience it in, you know, real life. I haven't been able to go to a single festival, neither from like my first short or my second short, not a single one, which is insane. So I'm just trying, you know, everything nice, you know, every little piece of joy or like success, you really nurture it because you're like, okay, I can't even enjoy it really, but I can
know what you mean. Well, nobody can do anything now, but there is such a sense of celebration when a project is done and then you're at the film festival and everybody's hanging out and then people appreciate what you've done. They come up to you. Yeah. There definitely is a nice feeling of a family at those film festivals, isn't it? Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Now you have a new movie coming out called Silent Lies, and I'm anxious to hear a little bit about that. But listen, let's move on with the show here and let's hear your story about choosing to be a filmmaker. I know we've already covered a lot of it in a way, but let's hear some more stuff from you. So folks, wherever you are, please put your hands together for Victoria Lacoste.
Well, hello, my name is Victoria Lacoste and I'm here to tell you about how I chose to become a filmmaker, which is, you know, a long story, but I'll try to make it as, you know, as nice and short as possible.
No, it doesn't have to be at all.
No, but really when I was, I think I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker, or at least, you know, an actor when I was 10 years old. And it came because my mother, out of all people, even though my family isn't really in the industry, my mother decided to take me to a theater class because she thought it'd be good for my self-confidence. And I kind of remember because I was a very, you know, shy. I was pretty shy. I honestly didn't have a lot of friends. And I think it was a way to socialize me. And she was like, just, you know, could be a good thing. And to me, that was like, honestly, I remember feeling like it was kind of hell on earth because I was like, I'm going to be confronted with people who are going to, you know, judge me. I'm going to have to be on stage. Like, I just remember doing it, but really going kind of against my will, being like, okay, fine. Like, if it makes you happy, I'll give it a shot. And it was one of these, no, seriously, it was because I was like, this is horrible. And actually it was one of these things where it was very much felt like love at first sight, I guess, where being on stage, there was a feeling once I stepped on a stage that I never got with anything else in my life. And you just, it's hard to explain if you haven't experienced it, but there's a feeling when you find yourself in front of an audience, it's like all the fear, all the insecurities, all the things that I was feeling that were, especially at the time, when you're, you know, you're a child and you're, you know, I was bullied a lot. So it was, I didn't have a lot of self-confidence. So it was all of a sudden being in front of an audience to be able to kind of express something through a character and being in front of these people and having all the fears just vanish. And that was something I never forgot. And it's quite addictive. So I think that's really how it started, is I was like, okay, I have to be doing this for the rest of my life. I want to be on stage, really. And then I took, you know, did also some singing, musicals, you know, when I was like a, not quite a teenager, from the age of 10 to 13, 12, 13 years old. And like did things to really challenge myself. I never wanted to become a singer, but I thought, you know what, I had these opportunities come up and I thought, I'm going to explore what I need to explore, because I was, that was kind of like an escape from what I've experiencing. Like I wasn't very, a very, like things were difficult at school. So I had this very much this outlet, to express myself in a way that.
What kind of school did you go to?
I went to a school that actually started, so I went to two schools. I went to a primary school and then I went to a private school that actually started, because in the States, slightly different from like fifth grade till the SATs, like the equivalent of the SATs. So you basically spent 8 years with the same people, which is insane.
Is that bad? Is that bad?
I think it is when you end up with assholes. Yes, it is. I'm joking. Yes, it is. I'm going to be honest. It's pretty. Okay. It is. Yeah, it is. Because if you have people that you don't like, you are stuck with them for 8 years. And there's some change, obviously, during these years. There's a little bit of like, there's a little bit of flux, but you do. It was a very, let me put it this way. It was a very particular, like school, very particular, with very particular energy, because I actually grew up, you know, I grew up in the more in the, you know, outside of the city, and all of a sudden I was in like a city school. And it sounds a little cliche, but when you all of a sudden you find yourself in, you know, a private school that's like this like thing where, you know you're going to be there for 8 years and you're with people who have known each other from before, and you're like, what is this? And it was also a bilingual school. So we actually, half of my classes were in German, in fact, because, so it was just, you know, it was a little tough. And so I think, having always been a creative person, you actually, you know, I think that really tapped into something I needed, and having, being able to create. And once I stepped, you know, on stage, I was like, this is kind of what's been missing, so to speak. It's like that missing, that thing where I was like, oh, that makes me really happy. That makes me really happy. I feel complete, which I'm genuinely sounds, yeah, can sound a little cliche, but it's really, there's nothing quite like it. So once that happened, I kept doing a little bit of theater. And then, you know, at the end of school, like my like school years, I was still pretty hell bent on doing acting. But I think at the time, you know, I it was difficult because, as you said, you know, I come from a background that's very much different. And my parents actually, surprisingly enough, were very supportive of me wanting to do what I wanted to do. And I'm very lucky, because a lot of parents, you know, if you're like, okay, so I want to be an actor, but I don't just want to be an actor. I actually want to be an actor in the United States, because I had, you know, for a long time kind of harbored this, I don't want to call it an obsession. Oh, it was a slightly obsession to like move there at some point, because I never saw myself live in Switzerland my whole life. I wanted to leave at all costs. You know, you go through like a rebellious phase. You're part, you know, you have a certain background, a certain name, and I know a lot of people are tempted to see the glam that's around a name, and they'll probably listen to it being like, well, what do you have to complain about? Because obviously you had everything. Like, yes, on paper, yes, I absolutely did. But I think I was really wanting to sort of start anew in a place where no one knew me, where I could just completely be myself, where I could work in what I wanted to work in. And where I grew up, it just wasn't possible, because the Geneva where I grew up, it's very much more of a financial city by the very nature of it. And the people there is art, obviously. And I had a lot of creative friends, but it's not a place you need to go to a bigger place if you want to actually pursue your dreams. And so I think I knew that from a very young age, that was kind of the key to just, you know, where I wanted to be. So I thought, well, I've always wanted to live in the States, because it was a lifelong dream. And I want to be an actor. And those things actually go well too, hand in hand, because there's a big acting industry. So I was lucky that my parents, when I told them at age 10, I was like, Mom, like, I want to be an actor, and someday I'll move there. And it was never, I meant it. And actually from then on, it was, that was the thing that I wanted to do. You know, so anyway, I moved, basically moved to the United States. I studied, I did a bachelor in theater. But when I was there, you know, I also, spent a lot of time doing short films,
in LA,
you know, and that was in Colorado actually.
Oh,
I studied in Colorado for 4 years, and that's actually where I met Kelsey Bolig, with whom I did two shorts that I think are incredible, because she's, I mean, one of the most talented people I've ever met in my life. And I met her actually in college, and that was one of these things where we just instantly connected. And when she graduated college, I still had a couple years to go. And she was like, you know, like, you should really move to Los Angeles. And I, you know, my visa, I had 1 year more where I could kind of choose where I wanted to go. And I was like, you know, that wasn't the city where I actually pictured myself. If I'm perfectly honest, I actually saw myself more living in New York, because I'm more of a more East Coast in many ways. I think it's because being European, there are some elements of the way of life, the culture, that are very similar. So I feel more at home on the East Coast, but I still love California. I adore it. But there are some, you know, cultural things where you just kind of mesh with. And she was like, you should move there. And I was like, you know, I'll think about it. And when I moved there, I realized it's, you know, sometimes I think things in life happen for a reason, where she said that. And I felt, you know what, I think, you know, we should work on something together, because she's the first person who really, not the first person, but when I was in college, she was someone who was really key in inspiring me to be part of the field, because, you know, it's a hard field. Even studying it, you know, it was not an easy experience, in a sense that, I mean, again, I was, again, far away from my family, in a different culture, acting in a different language, even though I was fluent. Like, it was a challenge. Every bit of it was a challenge. So it was great to meet someone who, you know, when you meet someone who really believes in your talent. And I think she was, you know, she was also one of these people that was so key in giving me that boost, that chance. So once I moved to LA,
Was that at UC Boulder?
Yes, it was. It was university. Yeah, exactly.
And you met in a class?
No, we actually met at an audition, because one day I saw an audition form for like an open call audition, camera audition. And I thought, well, I've never acted in front of a camera. But I'm going to go for it, because I need to meet people. And I want to give it a shot. And I remember it was one of the most surreal experiences, because I'd never even acted in front of camera, let alone auditions, which is a whole different gambit. And I thought, it was like, I blanked. I remember walking into a room and just seeing, and there was just a spotlight, and I couldn't see anyone behind that. I was like, I'm just going to wing it. I had a monologue. I was like, my English wasn't as good. Like, I wasn't as trained. I was just like, okay, I'm just going to go for it. But I remember this moment like it was yesterday, because I was like, let's do it. And I remember at the end, she came up to me. She was like, wow, like, this was incredible. Like, she was so kind. She was like, I really want you to be the lead in my short. That was like, you know, Shorts You Do University was like her little thesis film, little thesis horror movie, zombie horror movie. So we filmed this in the hallways of her apartment complex. And I was like, oh my God, like, it's, even though it was like a small project, you're like, wow, someone, it means a lot. We're the first person that really, you know, my parents obviously have always believed in me. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let me, like, leave and do the thing I did. But it means a lot when someone who is pursuing the same field you are gives you that kind of push. And it meant the world at the time. And it still does mean the world. So I think from then on, we just had this friendship. And every time she made, like, a project, she was like, you have to, you know, come on to my film. And eventually, when she moved to Los Angeles, when she graduated, she's a couple years older, I ended up joining her effectively in Los Angeles. And we, you know, decided we, you know, I built, you know, had a production company. I was, you know, decided, I was like, I need to start kind of nurturing my own projects. And one day she came up to me with the script for Asking for a Friend. And she was like, well, I have this great, she calls me, she's like, listen, are you sick of, you know, reading for projects that are really bad in audition rooms? Like, don't you just want to make something? And I was like, you know what? Yes, I absolutely do. Like, I was like, this is the, I felt like inherently this was the way to go, especially because when I think, again, I don't think there's any coincidence, because when I got to LA, it was just at the start of the Me Too movement. It was really at the cusp when things were starting, not quite shifting, but starting to. And I could see the wind turning. And I thought, you know what? Like, this is the moment. If we're going to make something happen, I could, you know, sometimes you just know, it's like in your core, you're like, yes, we have to make something together. Also, because I knew she's, you know, she's crazy talented. And I read the script and it was an obvious, like, well, duh. Like, I get to, you know, I'm going to act in it. You're going to direct it. We're going to showcase, you know, I had a little production company. I was like, we're going to make this happen. So we did. And we made Asking for a Friend. We filmed it in Los Angeles. And then I left. I came back to Switzerland because my visa had expired. And then we, you know, I did a premiere. I did a little premiere in France. And then someone came up to me and was like, I have a, you know, there, you know, you should keep making projects, making shorts. And I have actually a theater, and I've always wanted to film a film in the theater. And she was like, do you think maybe both of you could like do something with this? And I was like, yeah, brilliant. And so then it just kept going. And I called Kelsey. I was like, listen, could you write a horror movie that takes place in a theater? Yes. And that's how the fourth wall, and that is how the fourth wall was born. It was just a succession of really weird, you know, really weird things, but like encounters that have led us to make two pieces that I believe are, you know, and I don't say that because I've made them. And I say that really with like, not, you know, because I mean, in all humility, in a sense that the energy that surrounded both projects, because of the friendship we have and the experiences and so many stories that surrounded them in the very nature, they're so unique. And I think we created something that's just hasn't been quite done in the same way before. And it just made, you know, it's one of these partnerships where, you know, she's now, you know, been offered several feature projects as a result of the fourth wall. And so I saw her, she got signed with CAA, and I was like, oh my, like, I saw her kind of blossom and grow into this incredible force. And I thought, well, okay, I love acting, but production also goes hand in hand. And I can pick, you know, maybe I can do this and I can start picking projects and a larger, you know, at a larger scale. Sure. So that's, you know, kind of one thing. It hasn't been very linear, and that's why the story feels a little bit all over the place, because life rarely is all that linear. It's just you meet someone and then, you know, the path creates itself in a very interesting ways and unexpected ways at times. But it definitely taught me to take opportunities, even if they seem outlandish. I, you know, and people around me were like, oh my God, yet again, Victoria is making a really weird decision. And then, you know, no, but I know that. So I was like, you know what? I'm glad I trusted my gut, because in the end, I'm, you know, even though there are a few years where it's just, you're like, you are winging it in some, to some extent. But I also think, you know, that's when trusting your gut is so important, because sometimes it really feels weird, but it's so right in a way. So,
well, you're very lucky, because you're very young to have these epiphanies and get on the right track. I mean, you're so fortunate, first of all. So then why did you go to Australia if you knew when you were 10 that this was your path?
Well, I think the reason why that is because at the time, so when I was 18 years old, so a lot of things in the, like, you know, when I was younger, it was a certainty. And sometimes when you get to be a teenager, well, there were, you know, there were not, let's put it this way, there were not very easy years before I turned 18. And I kind of grew this feeling of like, I need to get the hell away from where I am. Just because, you know, you're under a certain amount of scrutiny, because it, you know, the city I grew up in, it almost feels like a small town where everyone knows your business. And we were, you know, the family, you know, whenever you have a family business, things clash a lot, because, you know, families clash because that's what happens in a family. But when you add a business with it, it just becomes this very, it's very hard to live with, even if you love, you know, get along with my parents and everything. But I felt very suffocated, and I needed to get away and do something completely different. At least give myself a year to really think about what I wanted to do. Because sometimes, even though there's things that are obvious, you start doubting yourself, because people doubt you, because you doubt, most of the time you're doubting yourself. And so I thought, I also just wanted to take, because I knew I was going to, you know, study no matter what. And I wanted to give myself just a break from the pressure. I felt like I was almost like in a pressure cooker.
Yeah. It's just really interesting because it's like you went to Australia because you felt some safety there in terms of like, let me just breathe for a minute for a year, get my act together. But really you put yourself in a kind of a dangerous situation. Your parents must have been really scared.
They were definitely worried. They were scared at times because, you know, there were certain things. Like I never got myself in situations where I was like worrisome. I was still careful. Like, you know, I was always with
people. But you were moving.
But I was moving. And there were definitely times where they were worried for sure. Sometimes I'm like, why? Why did they let me do this? Why did they let me do this? But I also believe that I was still very aware at the time, even though, you know, you're always pretty immature when you're 18, but I was still very, very aware and trying my best to not put myself in situations that were too dangerous because, you know, and when you travel, there's always an element of danger when you're road tripping, you know, your car could break down. You could, you know, encounter dangerous people, but in a way, so can you. I've also had this at home. It's not exclusive to Australia, even though Australia is removed. So it wasn't so much the situation being dangerous that made it hard. It was just because all of a sudden you're on your own and you're like, I want to leave. I want to, you know, I want to get the hell away from everything. And then you're there and you realize, okay, this is very, you're confronted with yourself.
Yourself. I know. It's so smart in the end that your parents let you go because obviously you learned and then, you know, kind of, it sounds like you kind of sailed through school, which you may not have done if you hadn't done the gap year.
So I wouldn't say I sailed through it either. It was that also, you know, I would say all the years after all the years of college were also very, they were also challenging. Like none of it was, I wouldn't say anything felt like I sailed through it. I'm honest. It was, I learned a lot, but I wasn't, none of it was like this. I have no nostalgia. I'm happy. Yeah. I'm happy that I learned the things I did. And I think,
sure.
You know,
but I'm sure your parents were happy to see you at UC Boulder. It's a safe town. It's the Rocky Mountains. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Absolutely. No, they were happy. They were happy that I was pursuing what I wanted to pursue. And I was finding, you know, absolutely that I was finding happiness in this field. And that I was, you know, when I decided to start producing, they were definitely happy that there was this, how do I put it? There was this,
satisfaction,
that's the right word, satisfaction that came out of it, and that I was moving forward. And then, you know, once I was able to like put work out there and they saw that it was work, not only was it working, but it was actually pretty successful in their own right, it solidified that because they knew that they trusted me. But you know,
when you're making good choices.
Exactly. So,
okay. Now we got to wrap this up, man. I could talk to you all day. I could talk to you all day. You're so interesting, Victoria. Now I want to say this. I've been to Geneva, Switzerland, and and I have to tell you, I mean, I've always just felt it was like, so not that interesting because first of all, everything is a clock store or a watch store. Why are there so many watches?
Because that is one of the primary industries in Switzerland. That is one of the main economies is watchmaking. Like we have some of the best watchmakers in the world, if not the best, are Swiss. So it is a big part, you know, big part of our culture, so to speak. So you have, you know, obviously a lot of watchmakers, a lot of chocolate makers, because watches and chocolate like are, you know, two of our main products, I guess. So yeah, you have incredible. I mean, even seeing my brother's interned in a watchmaking, factory, and it's artisanal, and only a very few select people can do it. In Switzerland, we have a lot of specialties, some of the best specialists you'll ever meet are in Switzerland.
Interesting.
Like it's a very specialized country. So like when it comes to, you know, either, you know, watches or, you know, watchmaking or even, I don't know, like some of the best doctors or facilities, like we just have, you know, the country draws in a lot of specialists. And so watches are one of them. It's very minutious and, you know,
and on time and all those.
Yeah. And we, all the rigor, and we're pretty rigorous. Like, it's true. It's part of the, you know, it's the German influence.
How many watches do people in Switzerland own?
Ooh, some of them, some of them quite a bit. I never owned expensive watches. They were more like swatches when I was a kid. So it's kind of, I don't know. It really depends, but they're definitely, you know, at least a couple or three or four. Like, right. It's part of the,
in other words, it's the deal. Do you guys give each other watches for birthdays and holidays, or do you give each other Swiss Army knives?
I got both. Yes, I can attest. One of my gifts for my 18th birthday was a Swiss Army knife. It's true. I mean, for real.
I have one.
It's practical.
Of course it's practical. I have a tiny one from Switzerland, and it's a white one, and my name, Christine, is on it. And I did that, you know, when I was there in Switzerland. Okay. One more question. Geneva. Yeah. Why in Geneva, in the middle of the day, is there like several hours where there's nothing open to eat except for the Pizza Hut by the train station?
In the middle of the day. Oh, yes, because places are open early because people eat very early. That's just part of the culture. We eat dinner very early. So a lot of places are like open between noon and 2 p.m. That's very Swiss. Like, it's not a Latin country. Like, if you go to France, you can have restaurants open till 11. That's not the case in Switzerland. It's like you have these pockets of 2 hours to eat, and then
that is just so absurd to me. Like, it's so prohibitive. So then you're like, and you're, you know, an American, and there's nowhere to eat. So you go to the train station. There's a Burger King and there's a Pizza Hut. That's it.
Yeah, I know. If you definitely in the middle of the afternoon, there's not a whole lot to consume.
So when do you eat in Switzerland, please?
so funny we're having this conversation. We're
I need to know when I can get a meal in Switzerland, please.
Between noon and 2 p.m., definitely. Sometimes 3, sometimes open a little later. And in the evening, oftentimes restaurants open around 6, and then they close at 9. So it's not, you know, you have like,
you can't get late night meals.
You can. No. You definitely can, but they're not like high end. Like, they're more, you know, unless you go to some very, very fancy restaurants, are open later, of course, but you can. They're just not going to be, it's not going to be elevated. It's like, you know, when you get a, you know, I would get like a kebab, you know, when you come back, you know, from the bars and you get like a late night snack, but.
Okay. Does everybody in Switzerland eat fondue?
Yes, absolutely. That is. Yeah, 100%. That is. It's. I mean, there's the only place you can get really decent and the good fondue is in Switzerland. I apologize because French people have fondue as well. It's just not the same. You need to have it in Switzerland. Absolutely. I mean, we don't eat it every day because it's very heavy. I have it mostly in winter. And you know,
it's not only Swiss cheese.
It is. Yes, it is actually mostly it is Swiss cheese. Yes. Sweet, because that's, you know, maybe we, you know, you
wow.
But there are different recipes, and depending on the region, people have their own. There's not one way to make it, you know, it's regional. So some people like it with different types of cheese, some people like it with one type. I'm saying there's no right or wrong way. There are definitely wrong ways because I've definitely tasted fondues that were disgusting. But
there's no right or wrong way. It's just that in Switzerland it's right and everybody else is wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now I remembered why I wrote down Daryl Hannah, and it's because of this. When Jack, it's known, you know, it's kind of a myth. I don't know what it is. It's a story in America. When Jackie Kennedy found out that her son, John F. Kennedy Jr., the hottie guy, was dating Daryl Hannah, she was very disappointed because she said, "John, she's just an actress. Like,
really?
You've got to be kidding me."
Oh, and so that really.
And I think, again, it's that class system, or it's something about when you come from certain families, there's certain things expected of you.
Yes. I mean, thank God. And that's something I'm really thankful for. Thank God my parents really aren't like that. They really do not. They cared that we did well, but they never cared where. Like, it was kind of, I mean, my parents are very much like, do what you want, but if you do it well, you know, it's like whatever you decide to do. And I know that's not the case for a lot of families. And that's a very, I was very lucky in that way. And I know they had, I mean, it was hard because you still have expectations, of course, because of where you're from and what your name is. And there is that pressure is there no matter what, there's some kind of expectation. Even sometimes you put it on yourself. But at the very least, when it came to whatever we wanted to do, I never felt that. It was more like, okay, like you're going to do this, but just don't like do it really. And, you know, there's this definite expectation for like, you know, quality, but also expecting us to do something we like. And I know that's, you know, like I said, it's not something that I know a lot of people, I know a lot of friends of mine who decided to go into acting and their families did not get it. And you really looked down on them or didn't help them out. We're like, well, if you're going to do acting, we're not going to be supportive. And man, it's already a hard enough field. Like if your family doesn't support you or doesn't have your back, like that is, it's rough. Like it's already hard. So yeah, at the very least, but I know that where I was from, when I said, you know, I'm going to be an actor, the city, you know, where people really didn't understand, they've always looked at me like I was like some kind of weird alien anyways. So it was like, you know what? You already think I'm weird. At this point, it's like, whatever choice I make, they're going to think I'm weird anyway. So it's like.
Okay. Two more things and we got to wrap it up. Have you been to Zermatt?
Yes. Yes, I was. I was there this summer. It's stunning.
Zermatt is by far my favorite place in the world. I've been there twice and I think about it. I still think about it.
It's too.
Just so unbelievable.
I was there with my boyfriend, and actually it's funny because he's American, and it was my first time. It was both our first time going to Zermatt, and I'm Swiss and I'd never been. And we're like, you know, wow. I know. And we went there and we took the train up.
You have to take, there's only one little tiny red train that goes into the town. It's not attached to the Eurorail system. It's a different train. And you get into the town, and then from there, there's some golf carts, but not even many of those.
Not many of those. And then we hiked.
You walk to your hotel, and you hike, and you drink red wine, and you hear cowbells constantly.
Yes. Even where I grew up in the, you know, more in the countryside, and we had a lot of cows. Like, that's just like a sound. That's the sound of my childhood. So
I love that.
That's just my childhood. So yeah, it's very quintessential Swiss atmosphere.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, one more question. Why is the music in Switzerland so bad?
You mean, wait. Because there's, what do you call music, like the like, you know, with the horns, like the traditional music, or do you mean music?
No, not the guy on the cough syrup thing. No, not that. I'm just talking about like Switzerland as a whole. I feel like everywhere I'd go in Switzerland, they were playing bad, like not just bad music, but the worst music ever. Like they'd be playing, like I remember going to Zermatt and getting there and then taking the gondola all the way up to the very top, and you get to the top of the gondola. Have you done that in Zermatt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and then at the top, there's that ice cave, and you walk in the ice cave. So now you're pretty much like almost the top of the world in the middle of nowhere. And what are they playing? They're playing Olivia Newton-John, Let's Get Physical. That's like quintessential music in Switzerland. It's just they play the shittiest of the shit. Is that not true? I mean, just tell me.
I'm gonna offer a more. Yes, there is definitely some bad choices being made, but so is depending. I wouldn't say it's essentially. It's like only in Switzerland, but there is, it's also because Zermatt is like an older place. Like there are also a lot of older people, like the town in of itself. So
So then why aren't they just playing like Coltrane? Or why aren't they just playing some soft Miles Davis? Why do they have to play Andy Gibb at the top of the world, the most beautiful place in the world, and you're hearing shadow dancing? What is happening?
That is really funny. I know.
Ask your boyfriend. I want you to ask your boyfriend because he'll say, oh yeah, I do remember how shitty the music is.
You know what? He probably would say the same thing. You know, it's sad because in Switzerland, there's also a crazy great artistic culture and like the best music festivals. And I can't, you know, hot take, but it's also not entirely wrong. Some of the best music festivals in the world are in Switzerland. Like when it comes to hosting culture, Switzerland is incredible. Zermatt, you know, Zermatt is an older town. There are definitely small towns where it's just people aren't as caught up to like more modern, you know, more things. It really depends on where you are. But when it comes to music, like music, some of the best concerts I've been to were in Switzerland. Like there is a lot of variety in what people listen to. But yes, it's, you
okay,
know.
Okay, Victoria, you keep telling yourself that.
I promise. Listen, it's true. I mean, Czech music festivals. I mean, that's what we host. I mean, yeah, we have huge festivals.
Okay.
For real. For okay. Real, for real.
Okay. Yeah, all yeah, right. Yeah. Well, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. Merci beaucoup. Listen, you guys, this has been so much fun. Boy, Victoria, I'll tell you what, I could talk to you for so long. You're just amazing. And you guys got to check out Victoria Lacoste. You can check her out at her website, victorialacoste.com. And of course, follow her on Instagram at Victoria Lacoste. And you can find me over there as well at Storyworthy. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Victoria. Really, you're very interesting.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You're going to have a ton of success. I know it. We're going to see your name everywhere. It's going to be so, really, it's going to happen. You'll see. I know it.
Oh, I very, very appreciate, I very much appreciate the vote of confidence. It means a lot. And I'm sure our paths will cross, hopefully cross in
LA. You come in back, real, you come back after this pandemic is over, please.
I will. I absolutely will. And I know our paths will cross in yeah, real life this time.
I hope so
I'm
too.
I'm excited.
All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of Victoria Lacoste, my name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.